Rather, it's how many of those planets are capable of supporting life. This is the next term in the Drake equation. The average number of planets per star that has planets that can support life, NE. This is sometimes referred to as the Goldilocks question. How many of those billions of planets are not too hot and not too cold, but just right to allow life to exist on their surface? The recipe for life. Why Earth? What is it about our planet that makes it a home for life? In 2008, NASA brought together a team of scientists to define in the most basic terms the properties a planet needs to have a chance of supporting life, given our current scientific knowledge. Top of the list was liquid water, an ingredient virtually every biologist would agree is necessary for life. Water is a uniquely complex liquid, with its simple H2O molecules forming great complexes held loosely together by hydrogen bonds. It forms the scaffolding around which biology happens, holding molecules and orientating them in just the right way for chemical reactions to take place. It is a superb solvent and remains a liquid over an unusually large range of temperatures and pressures. It has been said that we will never truly understand biology until we understand water. Such is its role in the chemistry of life on Earth. Fortunately, water is abundant in the universe. Hydrogen is the most common element, making up 74% of the matter in the universe by mass. Oxygen is the third most abundant, at around 1%, and these two reactive atoms combine to form water whenever they can. Water has been present in the universe for over 12 billion years, which we know because we've seen it. In July 2011, a giant reservoir of water was detected around an active galaxy known as APM 08279+5255. The cloud contains over 140 trillion times the amount of water in Earth's oceans, and is over 12 billion light-years away, having formed less than 2 billion years after the Big Bang. So water is necessary for biology, and fortunately, extremely common throughout the universe. Earth is unique in the solar system, however, because it is currently the only place where the surface conditions are right for water to exist in all three of its states, solid, liquid, and gas. There are ice sheets at the poles and on the summits of the highest mountain peaks. In the atmosphere, clouds of water vapor form and fall as rain and snow, flowing back through rivers into the oceans that cover over 70% of the surface. Mars has water, but on the cold red planet, it can only be found as ice trapped in the poles and deep below ground, and just possibly as subsurface liquid lakes. Venus may once have been wet, but its proximity to the sun and runaway greenhouse effect boiled any primordial oceans off into space long ago. This appears to suggest that it is Earth's distance from the sun that defines its suitability for life. Drag the Earth closer to the sun, and the temperatures would rise, the oceans would evaporate into the atmosphere, and if things got too hot, the water molecules would escape into space, leaving Earth a dry Venusian world. Drag the Earth further out towards Mars, and the temperatures would drop until eventually the surface water would freeze. It might appear tempting, therefore, to look for planets at roughly the same distance from their stars as Earth in the search for living worlds. This would be oversimplistic, because things are a lot more complicated. The conditions on the surface of a planet depend on many factors, the distance to the star being only one. The mass of the planet determines the gravitational pull it exerts on the molecules in its atmosphere, and this determines which atmospheric molecules it can hang on to at a given temperature. This is important because the atmosphere plays a critical role in setting the surface temperature of a planet. Venus has the hottest surface in the solar system other than the sun because of its greenhouse gas-laden atmosphere, despite being much further away from the sun than Mercury. The Moon, on the other hand, has very little atmosphere due to its small mass, and even though it is the same distance from the Sun as the Earth, its surface temperatures range from over 120 degrees C in direct sunlight to below minus 150 degrees C at night. NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter measured the coldest temperature ever recorded in the solar system, minus 247 degrees C, in the limb of a crater at the Moon's north pole, which never receives sunlight because the Moon's spin axis is almost perpendicular to its orbital plane. The composition of the atmosphere is determined in part by the geology of the planet. On Earth, plate tectonics play an important role in regulating the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and higher concentrations of such gases raise the temperatures. The presence of sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere from volcanic eruptions can cool the surface of a planet, however, because sulfate aerosols reflect sunlight back out into space. The Mount Pinatubo eruption in June 1991 cooled the Earth's surface by up to 1.3 degrees for the 3 years following the eruption. And we shouldn't forget that life itself alters the composition of planetary atmospheres quite radically. Earth's atmosphere today is a product of the action of living things. Before photosynthesis evolved, there was very little free oxygen in the atmosphere, and plants play an important role in removing CO2 and locking it up in biomass. The planet's mass, spin axis, orbit, geology, and atmospheric composition all conspire in a complex way to set the average surface temperature and atmospheric pressure, which ultimately determine whether liquid water can exist on the surface. And if life gets going, its effects have to be folded in as well. Beyond the planet, a vitally important ingredient for producing a potentially living world is, of course, the parent star itself. And all stars are most definitely not alike. There are over 200 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. The largest known supergiant stars are over 1,500 times the diameter of our Sun. If such a star were located at the center of our solar system, it would engulf Jupiter. At the other end of the spectrum are tiny red dwarfs with diameters from around half that of our Sun to as small as a tenth of it. The smallest known star at the time of writing goes by the name of 2-mass JO52338221403022, which shines 8,000 times less brightly than our Sun and is smaller but denser than Jupiter. As with virtually everything in physics, a good way to make sense of this stellar menagerie is to draw a graph. The most famous graph in all of astronomy is known as the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, after astronomers Einar Hertzsprung and Henry Norris Russell, who drew it independently in 1911. They plotted the surface temperature of the stars, which is directly related to their color. Hot stars are blue or white-hot, cool stars are red, against their brightness. It is immediately obvious that the stars are not distributed randomly on the diagram. Most lie on a sweeping line ascending from the bottom right to the top left. This line is known as the main sequence. Our yellow Sun lies around the middle of the main sequence, and all the stars on this line are generating their energy in the same way, by fusing hydrogen into helium in their cores. These are the standard stars, if you like, although their masses, lifetimes, and suitability for the support of living solar systems are very different. The basic physics underlying the main sequence line is simple. Stars are clouds of hydrogen and helium, which is pretty much all there is in the universe to a good approximation, collapsing under their own gravity. As the cloud collapses, it heats up. This is not surprising. All gases get hot when they're compressed. Try pumping up a bicycle tire. Eventually, the collapsing ball of gas gets so hot that the positively charged hydrogen atoms overcome their mutual electromagnetic repulsion and fuse together in a nuclear reaction to make helium. This releases a tremendous amount of energy, which further heats up the gas, increasing the rate of nuclear reactions and continuing to heat the gas. Hot gases want to expand, and so ultimately a balance will be reached between the crushing force of gravity and the outward pressure exerted by the nuclear heated gas. This is the current state of our Sun, happily converting 600 million tons of hydrogen every second into helium to counteract the inward pull of gravity. For less massive stars, the equilibrium will be reached at a lower temperature, because the inward pull of gravity is weaker. Having a lower surface temperature, these stars will be redder than our Sun and also less luminous. These are the dim red stars at the bottom right of the diagram, known as red dwarfs. We've already met an example of a red dwarf, our nearest stellar neighbour, Proxima Centauri. Red dwarfs also have the longest lifetimes of the stars on the main sequence, simply because they have to burn their fuel at a lower rate in order to reach a stable equilibrium with gravity. At the other end of the main sequence are the massive blue stars. 10 times the mass of our Sun or more, the inward pull of gravity is strong, and they have to burn their hydrogen fuel at a profligate rate to resist collapse. This makes them hot, and therefore blue, but also short-lived. The largest main-sequence stars will use up their nuclear fuel in 10 million years or less, at which point they will move off the main-sequence to become red giant stars. The red giants, like the famous Betelgeuse in the constellation of Orion, are stars nearing the end of their lives. Starved of hydrogen in their cores, they begin to fuse helium into heavier elements like carbon and oxygen. These stars are the origin of most of the heavy elements in your body. Their cores become superheated in their ultimately futile battle against gravity, causing their outer layers to expand and cool. This is why the red giants sit at the top right of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. They are vast and therefore bright, but their cool surfaces cause them to glow a deep red. Red giants will last for only a few million years before they run out of nuclear fuel, at which point they shed their outer layers, forming one of the most beautiful sights in nature, a planetary nebula. It is these clouds, rich in carbon and oxygen, which ultimately distribute the building blocks of life into the galaxy. Your building blocks are likely to have been part of a planetary nebula at some point over 5 billion years ago. Cooling at the heart of the nebula is the fading core of the star, exposed as a white dwarf. These stars populate the bottom left of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. There are a handful of other exotic stars out in the Milky Way. The vast blue supergiant stars like Deneb are extremely hot and extremely luminous. Deneb, the brightest star in Kepler's field of view in the constellation of Cygnus, is almost 200,000 times more luminous than our Sun, and 20 times more massive. It burns its nuclear fuel at a ferocious rate, and will probably explode in a supernova explosion within a few million years, leaving a black hole behind. The Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, then, is the key to understanding stellar evolution, and also contains vital information for planet hunters. Stars that do not lie on the main sequence are highly unlikely to support planetary systems with the right conditions for life. They are either short-lived and ferociously bright, or have had a life history fraught with violence and change. The main sequence, containing the stable hydrogen-burning stars, is where we should look for stability. But even there, the more massive, brighter stars are likely to be too short-lived for complex life to emerge. On Earth, life existed for over 3 billion years before complex organisms emerged in the Cambrian explosion just 550,000 years ago. We will discuss the history of life on Earth in more detail a little later, but for now, we might venture an educated guess that stars with lifetimes significantly shorter than a billion years or so are unlikely to preside over planets with intelligent civilizations. This rules out the blue stars at the top left of the main sequence. Even familiar stars like Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky and only twice the mass of the Sun, can probably be ruled out as its lifetime on the main sequence is expected to be a billion years at most. We are therefore left with stars on the main sequence with masses within a factor of 2 or less of our Sun as candidates for solar systems that could support complex life. There may also be a lower limit on the masses of life-supporting stars, although this is very much an active area of research. Around 80% of the stars in the Milky Way are red dwarfs, and many are known to have solar systems. Red dwarfs have potential lifetimes measured in the trillions of years, so there's no issue with their longevity. Despite their frugal use of fuel, however, red dwarfs tend to be volatile and variable in their light output. Sunspots can reduce their brightness by a factor of 2 for long periods of time, and violent flares can increase their brightness by a similar factor over time periods of days or even minutes. Planets in orbit around red dwarfs are therefore subject to significant and rapid changes in the amount of light and radiation they receive. Furthermore, because of their low light output, planets must be extremely close to the star if they're to be warm enough for liquid water to exist on the surface, irrespective of the details of their atmospheres. When planets orbit close to stars, they become tidally locked, with one hemisphere permanently facing the star and the other always facing into the darkness of space. We only see one face of our moon for the same reason. Tidal locking is inevitable for moons orbiting close to planets or planets orbiting close to stars. This results in a strange kind of climate for potentially habitable planets around red dwarf stars. There will be regions of permanent day and regions of permanent night. Despite all these problems, however, recent computer modelling suggests that red dwarf planets may be able to maintain stable surface conditions if they have thick insulating atmospheres and deep oceans, and life has plenty of time to evolve in these unfamiliar to us conditions. The jury is still out as to whether the red dwarfs that populate the low-mass region of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram could be candidates for living solar systems. Where does all this leave us? If we take the conservative path and focus our attentions on the sun-like orange and yellow stars on the main sequence, we can look at the Kepler data to estimate how many of these so-called F, G, and K-type stars in the Milky Way have rocky planets in the right orbits to allow liquid water to be present on the surface, at least in principle. These planets orbit within what is known as the habitable zone, and this is the number we want to measure and insert into the Drake equation. This has been done, and the results are surprising. In a recent study, 10 planets were identified as Earth-like in the Kepler dataset, in the sense that they have the right mass and composition, and are in the right orbits around their parent main sequence F, G, or K stars to support liquid water on their surfaces for long periods of time. Applying all the statistical corrections to account for the alignment of the solar systems relative to Earth, the lack of ability to see planets with longer orbital periods, and so on, we can estimate with a reasonable degree of certainty that there are around 10,000 Earth-like planets capable of supporting life in Kepler's field of view. This in turn suggests that around a quarter of F, G, and K stars in the Milky Way have potentially life-supporting planets in orbit around them, corresponding to 10 billion habitable planets. If we allow the possibility that planets around red dwarfs may also be habitable, then we can more than double that number. There's one final point worth making about habitable zones around stars. In our solar system, Venus, Mars, and Earth are within the habitable zone as commonly defined, but there are other places where life may exist. Several of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are planet-sized worlds, and it is known that the Jovian satellites Europa and Ganymede, and quite possibly Saturn's giant moon Titan and the small but active Enceladus, have subsurface oceans or lakes of liquid water. Europa, in particular, is considered to be one of the most likely places beyond Earth that may support life, even though it is outside the more commonly defined habitable zone around the Sun. If we admit the possibility that planet-sized moons may extend the habitable zone around stars, then the number of potentially life-sustaining worlds in the Milky Way increases significantly. Over 50 years after the Green Bank meeting, the first three astronomical terms in the Drake equation are now known from experimental data, and they are encouraging for SETI. There are, of course, large uncertainties, and one can find differing interpretations of the data in the academic literature. What is absolutely clear, however, is that the number of potential homes for life in the Milky Way is measured in hundreds of millions at the very least, most likely billions. From an astronomical perspective, the Milky Way could be teeming with life. The next three terms in the Drake equation are biological. They concern the probability that life will emerge spontaneously on a planet that could support it, and the probability that the necessarily simple life that first appears evolves into complex intelligent beings capable of constructing a technological civilization. It is to these difficult questions that we now turn. Origins. Earth formed 4.54 plus or minus 0.07 billion years ago out of the flattened disk of dust orbiting our young sun. The planet was far from hospitable for the first few hundred million years of its life. It was an intensely hot and volcanic world, bombarded by asteroids and comets, and at least once it collided with another planet, which resulted in the 23.5 degree tilt of our spin axis and the formation of the moon. Slowly, the solar system became a more ordered place, and Earth cooled to the point where liquid water could exist on its surface. There's evidence that liquid water existed as far back as 4.4 billion years, but it's certain that our planet was blue by the end of the late heavy bombardment 3.8 billion years ago, and around this time we find the first evidence of life. Structures known as microbially induced sedimentary structures were discovered in 2013 at a remote site in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. They were found in a sedimentary rock layer laid down in the early Archean period 3.48 billion years ago. Similar structures are found today along ocean shorelines and in rivers and lakes, formed by the interaction of microbial mats with sediments carried through them by water currents. They indicate the presence of a complex microbial ecosystem, most likely a purple layer of slime that thrived in the warm, wet, oxygen-free environment of the early Earth, filling the atmosphere with the sulphurous stench of anaerobic breath. Early Earth would not appear welcoming to our eyes or noses. Beyond 3.5 billion years, there's indirect evidence for the existence of life as far back as 3.7 billion years. Geologists studying some of the oldest sedimentary rocks on Earth in the Ishua supercrustal belt in western Greenland analyzed the ratio of carbon isotopes in sedimentary rocks. The ratio of the heavier carbon-13 isotope to the more common carbon-12 can be used as a biomarker because organisms preferentially use the lighter carbon-12 isotope in metabolic processes. Around 98.9% of naturally occurring carbon is carbon-12, and if the concentration is significantly higher in a particular rock deposit, then this is taken as evidence that the carbon was laid down by biological processes. What can this evidence tell us about the probability of life emerging spontaneously on other worlds? The problem is that Earth is a sample size of one, so it would be erroneous to draw firm conclusions. It's interesting to observe that life emerged very early in the Earth's history, probably as soon as the conditions were right. The first half a billion years after Earth's formation is known as the Hadean Aeon, named after the Greek god of the underworld. It's likely that the carbon dioxide atmosphere, volcanism, and frequent bombardment from space made life impossible on the surface during the Hadean. From the start of the Archean Aeon, 4 billion years ago, and certainly after the violent period of the solar system's history known as the Late Heavy Bombardment, which is known from analysis of lunar rocks to have ended 3.8 billion years ago, Earth became a more stable planet, and this date coincides with the earliest evidence for life. It's tempting, therefore, to suggest that life began on Earth pretty much as soon as it could have done after the violence of its formation. If this is taken as a working hypothesis, then we might venture that the probability of life arising on a planet that could support it, the term FL in the Drake equation, is close to 100%. This is, of course, speculative to say the least, and we would know this number with much greater certainty if we found that life arose independently on Mars, Europa, or one of the many bodies in the solar system that had or still have large bodies of liquid water on or below the surface. This is one of the most important motivations for the exploration of Mars and the moons of the outer solar system. A brief history of life on Earth. At this stage in the analysis of the Drake equation, it's looking promising for the alien hunters. There are billions of potentially habitable worlds in the Milky Way galaxy, and it's possible to interpret the early emergence of life on Earth as a hint, evidence would be too strong a word, that simple life may be inevitable given the right conditions. The next term in the equation turns out to be more problematic for the optimist, however. We need to estimate Fi, the fraction of planets with life that go on to develop intelligent life, and Fc, the fraction of those worlds on which civilizations develop the technology to be contactable. As for the origin of life, the only evidence we have can be found in the history of life on Earth. So let us briefly summarize what we know. The first population of living things whose descendants survived to the present day is commonly known as Luca, the last universal common ancestor. These four words mean something very specific. Because all living things on the planet today share the same basic biochemistry, including DNA, we may assert that all living things are related and share a common origin. Specifically, if you trace your personal lineage back to your parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and so on, you will find an unbroken line stretching all the way back to Luca. It's possible that life emerged more than once on Earth with different biochemistry, but we have no evidence of it. Luca may have been unrecognizable when compared to today's life, They may not even have been cellular in nature, but rather a collection of biochemical reactions involving proteins and self-replicating molecules, possibly contained inside rocky chambers around deep-sea hydrothermal vents. They would certainly have been simpler than the earliest known microbial mats. But somewhere in your genome, there will be sequences of DNA that have been faithfully passed down across the great sweep of geological time. And if you have children, you'll pass these 4 billion-year-old messages on to them. Our task is to try to estimate how likely it is that, given enough time, Luca will evolve into organisms capable of building a civilization. This is, of course, not precise. No accurate scientific statements can be made with a sample size of one. All we know for sure is that it happened here. The best we can do is trace our lineage back through time and try to identify potential bottlenecks along the way. Our species, Homo sapiens, emerged around 250,000 years ago in the Great Rift Valley of East Africa. Given that Homo sapiens is the only species to have built a civilization, the probability of our evolution from earlier hominin species is what we need to know to estimate FC. To summarize, the emergence of Homo sapiens was undoubtedly fortuitous, dependent on many factors, including, it appears, the geology of the Rift Valley itself and the details of cyclical changes in the Earth's orbit. But given enough time and the existence of large numbers of relatively intelligent animals on Earth, it is at least possible to imagine that some other creature might have made the long journey towards civilization at some point in the future, had we not emerged when we did. This is, of course, simply my opinion, and you should make up your own mind after reading further. Incredibly fortunate as we are to exist, therefore, I don't think the ascent from primates to humans is the most important evolutionary bottleneck in the road to technological civilization, given the pre-existing biological diversity on Earth and a few tens or hundreds of millions of years of stability into the future. Rather, I think we should direct our attention back over the much longer time periods between the origin of life on Earth and the emergence of the first intelligent animals. We are mammals, which first appeared 225 million years ago in the Triassic era. Dinosaurs also appeared around this time, a subgroup of archosaurs to which birds and crocodiles are related. The first evidence of large numbers of complex animals can be found around 530 million years ago, during a period of rapid biological diversification known as the Cambrian Explosion. The earliest fossils of multicellular organisms, known as the Ediacaran biota, have been identified as far back as 655 million years. Many of these organisms appear sponge-like or quilted, and nothing like them survives today. There's evidence of animal-like body plans in some Ediacaran fossils, with a clearly differentiated head, but because of their soft bodies, fossils are rare and relatively little is known about them. Beyond 655 million years ago, there is no evidence of multicellular life on Earth. The half a billion years or so from the Cambrian explosion to the present day is, in geological terms, relatively short, and life seems to have marched towards greater complexity ever since. This is a gross oversimplification, and we certainly do not suggest that evolution can be viewed as an inevitable march towards intelligence. One might be tempted to assert, however, that given something akin to a Cambrian explosion, the probability of developing intelligent life may be non-negligible, although there are scientists who will strongly disagree. There's a significantly longer stretch of time between Luca and the Cambrian explosion, over 3 billion years, and if we're looking for potential barriers to the emergence of intelligence, we should investigate the vast expanse of time before complex multicellular life appeared. Why did single-celled organisms remain simple on Earth for so long? Most biologists would point to at least two crucial evolutionary innovations that were necessary, though not sufficient, to trigger the Cambrian explosion. The first was oxygenic photosynthesis. An oxygen atmosphere is probably a necessary precursor for the development of complex living things. All multicellular animals today breathe oxygen. This is not a coincidence or a biological fluke. It is chemistry. We release the stored energy from our food by oxidizing it, a chemical reaction that's around 40% efficient in the presence of oxygen. Food can be oxidized by other elements, such as sulfur, but these reactions typically have an efficiency of 10% or less. If a food chain is to be supported, with predators eating prey that eat plants and so on, then oxygen is probably essential. Without it, the energy available for predators would diminish by 90% at each step in the food chain. This wouldn't simply mean that an oxygen-starved planet could be full of grazing animals like sheep and cows, but no predators such as cats or sharks or humans. The arms race between predators and prey was a vital evolutionary driver towards living complexity on Earth. Eyes, ears, and brains offer a survival advantage whether you are the hunter or the hunted. And if predation had been impossible for energetic reasons, it is far less likely, or perhaps impossible, that complex animals would have evolved. Photosynthesis has been around for a long time. The 3.5 billion-year-old Western Australian microbial mat structures are bacterial, and they were probably early photosynthesizers, using light from the sun to grab electrons off hydrogen sulfide and force them onto carbon dioxide to form sugars. They would not have used a pigment as complex as the green chlorophyll that colors the landscapes of Earth today. More likely, they would have used simpler molecules from the same family, known as porphyrins, which occur naturally and whose precursors have been found in moon rocks and in interstellar space. Living things are like electrical circuits. They need a flow of electrons to power their metabolism, and given the ready availability of sunlight and naturally occurring molecules that can be assembled into machines to capture it and deliver electrons, it's not too difficult to see how primitive photosynthesis might have appeared very early in the history of life on Earth. Given the obvious advantage of using the light from the sun to power the processes of life, it's not surprising that some early bacteria used photosynthesis for a different purpose, to synthesize a molecule known as adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, the energy storage system for life. ATP is one of the molecules that all living things share, and must therefore be very ancient, perhaps dating back to Luca and the origin of life. The type of photosynthesis found in modern plants, trees and algae, is a hybrid of these two processes, with an important twist. Crucially, the electrons are no longer taken from hydrogen sulfide, but from water. The fusion of these two slightly different types of photosynthesis and the use of sunlight to grab input electrons off water was the great evolutionary leap that led to the oxygenation of the Earth's atmosphere. Known as oxygenic photosynthesis, it evolved at some point earlier than 2.5 billion years ago. We know this because at this time, Earth started to rust, forming great orange iron oxide layers known as banded iron formations, and this requires the presence of large amounts of free oxygen in the atmosphere. Molecular oxygen is an unstable and highly reactive gas and must be constantly replenished. Astronomers in search of life on exoplanets would consider the detection of an oxygen atmosphere as a smoking gun for the presence of photosynthesis. Oxygenic photosynthesis is a terrifically complicated process, though. The molecular machinery is known as the Z scheme, and its operation has only been understood in detail in the last few years. The sugar manufacturing part alone, known as photosystem 2, consists of 46,630 atoms. The structure of the part that holds water molecules in place ready for their electrons to be harvested, known as the oxygen evolving complex, was discovered in 2006. It's perhaps not surprising, therefore, that the more primitive forms of photosynthesis were not combined together into the oxygen-releasing Z scheme for well over a billion years. Beyond the long timescales involved in the evolution of oxygenic photosynthesis, however, there's another piece of circumstantial evidence that may suggest an evolutionary bottleneck. All the green plants and algae that fill our atmosphere with oxygen today perform their photosynthesis inside structures called chloroplasts. Chloroplasts look for all the world like free-living bacteria, and that is because they were long ago. The story is that a bacterium, most likely one of the great family of early photosynthesizers known as cyanobacteria, was swallowed up by another cell and became co-opted to perform the complex task of grabbing electrons off water and using them to manufacture ATP and sugars, releasing the waste product, oxygen, in the process. This engulfing of one cell by another and the merging of their properties is known as endosymbiosis, an ability possessed by some cells that allows for step changes in living things through the wholesale merger of capabilities that evolved separately and over vast periods of time in different organisms. But here's the key point. Everything on the planet today that performs oxygenic photosynthesis does it using the Z scheme. And this strongly implies that it only evolved once, most probably in a population of cyanobacteria over 2.5 billion years ago. This tremendously advantageous innovation was so useful that it became co-opted into every plant, every tree, every blade of grass and every algal bloom on the planet, flooding the atmosphere with the oxygen necessary for the Cambrian explosion to populate Earth with endless forms most beautiful. If there were ever a smoking gun for a bottleneck, this is it. But how on earth does a cell learn how to engulf another one and survive? How did endosymbiosis arise? A clue, and perhaps an even more significant bottleneck, may be found in another prerequisite for the Cambrian explosion, the eukaryotic cell. All multicellular organisms are made up of cells known as eukaryotes, cells with a nucleus and a host of specialized structures, each charged with performing specific tasks. The eukaryotic cells in every living thing look so similar that an alien biologist, knowing nothing about planet Earth, would immediately recognize that human eukaryotes are closely related to those from a blade of grass. The earliest known eukaryotic cells date from around 2 billion years ago. Beyond this, simpler cells known as prokaryotes were the only living things on the planet. Bacteria and archaea, the two single-celled kingdoms of life that still flourish today, are prokaryotes. They are simple in the sense that they lack the vast, specialized machinery of the eukaryotes. Although, as we've seen, they do possess some vital and extremely complex abilities, photosynthesis being a very good example. The most striking difference between eukaryotes and prokaryotes is the eukaryote cell nucleus, which contains most of its DNA. In the story of evolution of life on Earth, however, it's the small amount of DNA stored outside the nucleus that's most revealing. Almost all eukaryotic cells contain structures called mitochondria. The word almost is used a lot in biology. Unlike physics, there always seem to be one or two exceptions that ruin sentences in books like this. Most biologists believe that even the eukaryotes that don't possess mitochondria did so at some point in the past, however, so we can take it that these structures are ubiquitous. Mitochondria are the power stations of the cell, and their job is to produce ATP. Around 80% of your energy comes from the ATP produced in mitochondria, and without them, you certainly wouldn't exist. A clue as to their evolutionary origin is contained in their DNA, which is stored in loops and kept separate from the genetic material in the cell nucleus. Bacteria also store their DNA in loops, and this is not a coincidence. The mitochondria were once free-living bacteria. The obvious question is, how did the bacterial mitochondria get inside the cells of every complex organism on the planet? The answer is through endosymbiosis, just as for the chloroplasts. But there is not universal agreement on the detail, and the detail matters a great deal. What's not in question is that the mitochondria are bacterial in origin. The debate surrounds the nature of the original host cell. One camp of biologists believes that the host cell was already a eukaryote, which over many millions of years had evolved an ability called phagocytosis, the ability to ingest other cells. This is a traditional Darwinian explanation, one in which complex traits evolve gradually over time via mutations and natural selection. If this is true, then it's possible to view the eukaryotic cell as just another evolutionary innovation, albeit a very important one, that might crop up anywhere, given enough time. The other possibility, which is favored by many biologists, has different implications. The idea is that the swallowing of the protomitochondrial cell was the origin of the eukaryotic cell itself. There was no such thing as phagocytosis or the eukaryotic cell before this singular event, and this fateful encounter changed everything. Recent DNA evidence suggests that the host cell was probably an archaean, one of the two great prokaryotic domains. Somewhere in some primordial ocean, this simple prokaryote managed to swallow a bacterium, a trick that neither cell possessed before, and against terrific odds, the pair survived and multiplied. The archaean gained a huge advantage, a previously unimaginable energy supply from the bacterium's sophisticated ATP factory. The bacterium also gained an advantage. It was protected, and over eons, could specialize and concentrate entirely on producing energy for its host. If this theory is correct, the origin of complex life on Earth was a complete accident. Without access to the energy supply from the mitochondria, all the complexities of the eukaryotic cell, which are absolutely necessary for complex multicellular life, would never have evolved. Earth would be a living planet today, but a planet of prokaryotes, and certainly not home to a civilization. I cannot tell you which of these two theories is true. If it were obvious, then all academic biologists would agree. But my impression is that the fateful encounter is currently the more widely accepted theory. And if it is correct, then this has very important consequences for estimating the probability of the evolution of intelligent life. Eukaryotes are absolutely essential for intelligence. There is no biologist who would suggest that the prokaryotes, for all their ingenuity in developing photosynthesis and mitochondrial machinery, would have managed to construct radio telescopes given enough time and a following wind. Without eukaryotes, there would be only slime. I think these are very important points to consider in the Drake equation. If it is correct that at least two of the necessary foundations for the emergence of complex multicellular life on Earth arose from barely credible accidents, then they might be seen as potential bottlenecks in the evolution of intelligence elsewhere in the Milky Way. So where are we in our attempt to estimate the chances that, given the origin of life on a planet, intelligence will arise? This is where we move from science to speculation and opinion. And with these caveats, let me give you my personal view. Given the eukaryotic cell and an oxygen atmosphere, life on Earth became diverse and complex relatively quickly. It's almost certainly no coincidence that the Cambrian explosion followed soon after a rapid rise in the oxygen content of the atmosphere. Whether it's possible to claim that intelligence on the scale necessary to build a civilization is likely given the right biological building blocks and enough time, half a billion years, let's say, is another question. We simply don't know. And the very specific conditions in the African Rift Valley that led to the emergence of early modern humans only 250,000 years ago might suggest that civilization-level intelligence is a rare development, even given animals as sophisticated as primates, never mind a eukaryote and an oxygen atmosphere. An optimist would assert that there are billions of potential homes for life in the Milky Way, and that since life emerged on Earth pretty much as soon as it could at the end of the violence of the Hadean, then the Milky Way must be teeming with life, and therefore civilizations. I would agree that the Milky Way must be teeming with life. I think there's a sense of chemical inevitability about it. Even accepting this line of argument, however, a pessimist would surely point to the evolution of the eukaryotic cell and oxygenic photosynthesis as being potential bottlenecks. On Earth, it took life over 3 billion years to get to the eve of the Cambrian. That's 3 billion years of planetary stability, a quarter of the age of the universe. If just one of the necessary steps, the fateful encounter, let's say, was at the fortunate end of a probability distribution, then one can easily imagine that the 20 billion Earth-like worlds in the Milky Way could all be covered in prokaryotic slime. A living galaxy, yes, but a galaxy filled with intelligence? Given what we know about the ascent from prokaryote to civilization on Earth, I'm not so sure. A briefest moment in time. Let's take one final journey back to Green Bank in 1961. Drake and his colleagues, with far less evidence than we have today, concluded that our galaxy seems remarkably conducive to life, full of Earth-like worlds warmed by the glow of benign stars. They too believed that a good fraction of these billions of worlds must be home to life, and given that Darwin's law of evolution by natural selection must apply across the universe, they concluded that intelligence must have emerged on at least some of these planets. As I've argued above, I'm not so sure about intelligence, but we must at least consider the possibility that potential evolutionary bottlenecks like the eukaryotic cell and oxygenic photosynthesis aren't as bad as they might appear. In this case, the final term in the Drake equation becomes all-important. Perhaps it is L, the lifetime of civilizations, that is the fundamental reason for the Great Silence. This is a sobering thought. The reason we've made no contact with anyone is not because of a lack of stars or planets or living things. It's because of the inbuilt and unavoidable stupidity of intelligent beings. This might seem a bit strong, but it's a view shared at Green Bank by Manhattan Project veteran Philip Morrison. Morrison was intimately involved in the design and development of the first atomic bomb, and he helped load Little Boy onto Enola Gay, destined for Hiroshima. The fact that human beings had deployed a potentially civilization-destroying weapon twice against civilian targets, and that Morrison had personally loaded one of the bombs, must have never left him. And on the eve of the Cuban Missile Crisis, it must have seemed likely that we would do it again on a much grander scale. Drake realized this as well, which is certainly one of the reasons why he introduced the time that a technological civilization can endure into his equation. We can, after all, only communicate with nearby civilizations if they exist at the same time as us. This is a possible resolution to the Fermi paradox. Civilizations inevitably blow themselves up soon after acquiring radio technology, and therefore the Milky Way will remain forever silent apart from the briefest, non-overlapping flickers of intelligence. This might seem like a solipsistic conceit. How can we possibly assume that human stupidity is universal? We can't, of course. But just as for the biological arguments we made against the inevitable emergence of complex life on an otherwise living world, we only have the Earth as a guide, and extrapolating from our own experience is the best we can do. On Earth, Rutherford discovered the atomic nucleus in 1911, and we destroyed two cities and killed over 200,000 of our fellow human beings with nuclear technology 34 years later. About 17 years after that, having seen the devastation nuclear weapons can cause, Khrushchev and Kennedy came close to ending it all. And to this day, we don't know how close we came to eliminating the fruits of almost 4 billion years of evolution. Here on Earth, it appears that sanity, perspective, and an appreciation of the rarity and value of civilization emerges after, and not before, the capability to build big bombs. We have the bombs, but I don't think enough of us have the rest. Why should other young civilizations be any different? If this is the reason for the Great Silence, then I suppose we might take comfort in the fact that we are not the only idiots to have existed in the Milky Way. But that's the coldest comfort I can imagine. The above might be seen as a naive rant, of course. One could argue that mutually assured destruction, the guiding principle of the Cold War, did act to stabilize our civilization and is still doing so today. Perhaps no intelligent beings will knowingly destroy their civilization, which is what global nuclear war on Earth would surely do. After all, Kennedy and Khrushchev ultimately took this view. Similarly, one assumes that the submersion of Miami and Norwich by rising sea levels would silence the so-called climate change skeptics, I'd call them something different, and trigger a change of policy that will avert catastrophic civilization-threatening climate change in good time. It seems to me, however, that a small planet such as Earth cannot continue to support an expanding and flourishing civilization without a major change in the way we view ourselves. The division into hundreds of countries, whose borders and interests are defined by imagined local differences and arbitrary religious dogma, both of which are utterly irrelevant and meaningless on a galactic scale, must surely be addressed if we are to confront global problems such as mutually assured destruction, asteroid threats, climate change, pandemic disease, and who knows what else, and flourish beyond the 21st century. The very fact that the preceding sentence sounds hopelessly utopian might provide a plausible answer to the great silence. So, are we alone? What, then, is the range of estimates for the number of civilizations in the Milky Way, given the limited evidence we have at our disposal? During the filming of Human Universe, Frank Drake told me that the Green Bank meeting came up with a number of around 10,000, and he sees no reason to change that estimate. This would be wonderful, and makes the search for signals from these civilizations one of the great scientific quests of the 21st century. I strongly support SETI, because contact with just one alien civilization would be the greatest discovery of all time, and it's worth the investment on that basis alone. There is, however, one piece of evidence that might suggest a more lonely position for us on our little home world. In 1966, the mathematician and polymath John von Neumann published a series of lectures entitled Theory of Self-Reproducing Automata, in which he analyzed in great detail the possibility of constructing machines capable of building copies of themselves. Such machines exist in nature, of course. All living things do this routinely. In principle, therefore, one might imagine a sufficiently advanced civilization building a self-replicating von Neumann space probe and launching it out to explore the galaxy. On reaching a solar system, the probe would mine the planets, moons, and asteroids, extracting the materials necessary to build one or more copies of itself. The newly minted probes would launch themselves out to neighboring solar systems and repeat the process, spreading across the Milky Way. Even given the vast distances between the stars, computer models assuming currently envisioned rocketry technology suggest that such a strategy could result in the exploration of the entire Milky Way galaxy within a million years. Science fiction? It certainly sounds like it. But if there's no objection in principle to the construction of a von Neumann probe, then one has to develop an argument as to why we don't see any. The reason that this is difficult to do is due to timescales. The Milky Way has been capable of supporting life for over 10,000 million years. It is possible to envisage many millions of civilizations rising and falling over such vast expanses of time, and if only one had developed a successful von Neumann probe, then the galaxy should be filled with its progeny. There should be at least one von Neumann probe operating in our solar system today. Carl Sagan and the astronomer William Newman noticed a flaw in this line of argument. If the probes multiply exponentially and unchecked, then one can show that they consume the resources of the entire galaxy relatively quickly. And we'd certainly have noticed that. Or more accurately, we wouldn't be here to notice that. Sagan reasoned that this obvious risk would be sufficient to prevent any civilization intelligent enough to build von Neumann probes from actually doing so. They would be doomsday machines. Other astronomers have countered that it wouldn't be beyond the wit of such an advanced intellect to build in some fail-safe mechanism that guaranteed, for example, only one probe per solar system, or a finite lifetime for each probe. Others have argued that there may indeed be a von Neumann probe operating in our solar system today with appropriate fail-safe mechanisms installed to stop it eating everything. If such a probe were relatively small, perhaps sitting amongst the asteroids or even the Kuiper belt of icy comets beyond the orbit of Neptune, then we'd almost certainly be unaware of its presence. Von Neumann probes wouldn't be the only signatures of ultra-advanced civilizations. Imagine a civilization many millions of years ahead of us, carrying out engineering projects on a galactic scale. Imagine interstellar starships, or great space colonies constructed in otherwise uninhabitable solar systems. Why not? As I said at the start of this chapter, we went from the Wright brothers to the moon in a single human lifetime, so I ask again, how far will we travel, if the laws of physics allow, given another 1,000 years? Or 10,000, or 1,000,000. What signature will we leave on the sky if we survive and prosper that long? None of these questions is trivial, because the sheer immensity of the timescales available for life to evolve in the Milky Way galaxy forces us to consider them. Why should we be the most advanced civilization in the galaxy when we've only been building spacecraft for half a century in a 13-billion-year-old universe? I don't have an answer to this. It bothers me. Perhaps the distances between the stars are indeed too great. Or perhaps there are insurmountable difficulties in building self-replicating machines or starships. But I can't think what they might be. I am tempted, therefore, to make the following argument for the purposes of debate. I think that advanced spacefaring civilizations are extremely rare, not because of astronomy, but because of biology. I think the fact that it took almost 4 billion years for a civilization to appear on Earth is important. This is a third of the age of the universe, which is a very long time. Coupled with the remarkable contingency of the evolution of the eukaryotic cell and oxygenic photosynthesis, not to mention the 500 million years from the Cambrian explosion to the very recent emergence of Homo sapiens and civilization, I think this implies that technological civilizations are stupendously rare, colossally fortuitous accidents that happen on average in much fewer than one in every 200 billion solar systems. This